you know I'm a sucker for an underdog story. I don't know if it's because I'm a hockey fan and my team are the Toronto Maple Leafs, who haven't played a meaningful hockey game in my lifetime. I mean, it's been since 1967 that they won a Stanley Cup, and my father was 8 years old at the time. Don't laugh too hard. I know you're a fan of the Sabres that have never won anything. But I don't know if that's why I'm an underdog fan. There's something about the downtrodden guys. I want the scrappy teams to win. I want the losers to win out. It's probably why I like the Mighty Ducks movies, or why Angels in the Outfield is one of my favorite 90s Disney films. It's why I read about the lives of Abraham Lincoln and enjoy it, or even knowing Sylvester Stallone's story. I love the underdog. Not that I'm equating Lincoln and Sly. I mean, Lincoln was no Sylvester Stallone. He hasn't won an Academy Award. But I love an underdog story. I think that's why I don't follow college basketball. My dad can't get that through his head that I don't. But when I heard about the game between UVA and the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the spanking that University of Virginia got at their hands, I loved it. I was in, even though they lost in the next round. But for like a day, I was a big fan of UMBC. It's why I cheered a little bit, just a little bit, for the city of Cleveland when LeBron came back. Now, that's not to say that I'm a fan of LeBron, guys. I know some of these fans are Golden State Warriors fans. That's not my deal, but Cleveland is an underdog. They've never won anything until LeBron, like, single-handedly won it for them. But I think that's why, in 2016, I became a Cubs fan. And now, so, I don't know, are there any Cubs fans here? All right, okay, so there's like one. All right, here's the thing. I'm a Canadian. There's only one Canadian baseball team, and they were the Blue Jays, and they haven't won anything since 1993. I remember that, though, so at least that's good. But I'm very much a bandwagon hopper when it comes to baseball. But there's something about the Cubs that resonate with me. It's probably because they hadn't won since 1908. So not my grandfather, but my great-grandfather was the last member of my family alive, who is long dead now, that would have been alive when the Chicago Cubs won a World Series. And so there was something about them just making the playoffs that kind of won me in. And one of my good friends is a big Cubs fan, so that probably helped. And watching them go through, you just were expecting them to choke. You were expecting somewhere along the way that they would lose. And so you get to the World Series, and they're finally on the big stage. And what do? They go down 3-1 in this best-of-seven series. In fact, their last game of Game 4 at Wrigley Field at home, they get spanked 7-2. And so, of course, the Cubbies are screwed at this point. They are cursed at this point. They're not going to win. But they win Game 5, they win Game 6, and they're up 6-3 in the eighth inning. And then they allow 3 runs. And of course, the curse is back, and I'm chatting, I'm texting with my friend, and he is dying. Like, I'm walking alongside him, he's like, we're going to lose. There's no way that we can win. So they go to the ninth, and there's nothing, it's going to take 10 innings. And I rewatched it this week. The last call, the last infield out, when that team lost their minds. And I tell you what, if you watched that game for a split second, you became a Cubs fan. Because it didn't matter the 108-year drought, it didn't matter how many times they let their fans down, and how many people that are in their 90s and into their hundreds that were Cubs fans from day one, suddenly it was all behind them. Suddenly the 3-1 deficit, blowing the lead, the years of futility were all wiped away. Because all that mattered was how the story ended. Because the end of the story for them made all the difference. My wife will not read, where's my wife? There's my wife. My wife will not read a book unless she knows how it ends. because there have been too many books. I mean, reading a book takes effort and it takes time. And why get into a book if it's gonna end lousy? And so Jen will tell, like, if you tell her, like, you should read this book, she'll be like, listen, here are my parameters for this, and I will read the last chapter. And let me tell you, if you one time vouch for a movie or a book and it ends up being terrible, she will never let you forget it. Because when we were first dating, I made her sit through a movie that had a lousy ending, and she still doesn't trust my judgment to this day. I mean, she's a very forgiving woman, but in that one case, I have no credibility. But she's not wrong, because you could sit through an amazing movie, and if it ends bad, it ruins the whole movie. It absolutely does. So there's something about the way a story ends that makes a difference. That's true of pretty much every sphere, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. It's why the story of the American Revolution is so incredible. I mean, for the longest time, it seemed like not only was Washington going to lose, but Washington wasn't even going to last the winter. But seeing the story of the turnaround and the victories and the defeat of the British, even though, like, I'm Canadian, so I kind of feel like, eh, about it. It's an amazing story. It's not a story that we focus on the bad that happens. What we see is the adversity that brought the victory and made the victory that much sweeter. When you look at World War II, we don't look at that as a defeat, because even though Germany seemed to have its way with Europe and was taking countries at will and seemed unstoppable, we don't look back and say that was a defeat. We look back and we venerate and we honor with exuberance the victories at Normandy Beach. And we honor D-Day, and we honor the victories in Europe and the victory in Japan, because even though it seemed like we were on the floor and the ref was counting us out, victory was grabbed out of the jaws of defeat. Because the ending of the story changes everything. And at the end of Luke 23, we see what appears to be the end of the story. In fact, Jesus' closest friends and allies are mourning because it seems as if there is nothing else to tell. Luke 23:46 tells us that about noon, Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And when he said this, he breathed his last. Jesus was dead. Any hopes for last-minute heroics were gone. We've said before, the problem for those who followed him, those who saw him as a Messiah or a Savior, a coming king, the problem now was that Messiahs were not supposed to die. You see, Messiahs in this day, people that were going to rise up and deliver Israel from the oppressive Greeks or the oppressive Romans, they were almost a dime a dozen. They came and they taught with charisma, and they led people up, and then they raised an army in revolt, and they were slammed down by the oppressive Roman military machine. There's a reason that you've never heard of guys like Simon the Star. Anyone heard of Simon the Star? Like, let's be honest. Of course you haven't heard of Simon the Star. Simon the Star was a would-be Messiah. He was charismatic. He was an extremist, and he rose up an army, and people, even Jewish rabbis, claimed this is the Messiah. Well, the Romans caught wind of this. He raised up an army. He fought against the Roman military machine, and like so many before him, he lost. And Simon the Star was executed, never to be heard from again. Messiahs aren't supposed to die. Saviors aren't supposed to die. And on that Friday, on this weekend, for 2.5 days, it seemed like it was all over. Jesus was dead, and he was laid to rest in the tomb of a wealthy man named Joseph. And it seemed like he would die like Simon the Star and countless other would-be messiahs before him as perhaps maybe a footnote in history, at best a footnote in history. His followers mourned him, not just because of the loss of a son or a friend or a leader, but because their hope for their lives was gone. To them, there was no more to tell. Death is the end. But that's not the end of the story. You see, if Jesus' story ended with his execution, it would be a tragedy. In fact, it would be little more than a footnote. There was a Jewish historian named Josephus that is the main reason why we know a lot about first century Israel, because very few people were writing down what was going on around them who weren't Christians. It's interesting, there was one major Roman historian that wrote about Jesus, but only because of the church of Jesus that came after him. Josephus wrote maybe a paragraph about this man named Jesus, who was called the Christ, who was crucified by the Romans. And that was about all that Josephus had to say about Jesus. And if the cross were the end, that would be all that there would be to talk about Jesus. Because if we're being honest, Jesus did very little in his life to warrant history's remembrance. Now, that's not to say that his teachings are meaningless and that his life had no purpose. Obviously not. They're perspective-altering, paradigm-shifting, dark-defeating life and teachings. But he was a carpenter from Nazareth who had a crowd follow him, but he didn't raise up an army. He didn't create a lasting political movement. And those are the kind of things that history tends to remember. Not a guy that taught and was executed so quickly and at such a young age. It is likely that none of us would have heard of Jesus if the cross was the end. But it wasn't. There was more to be told. John 20, verses 1 and 2 said that very early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. And she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they have put him." The beginning of the Easter narrative actually begins with a lot of confusion, because our first thought when we expect to find a body and a body is not there tends not to be resurrection. They assumed that grave robbers took him. And the disciples of Jesus didn't even entertain the notion at first. In fact, in Luke 24, when they're told that the tomb is empty, and they tell the disciples that now an angel has appeared to them, telling them that Jesus was not dead, that he had risen, Luke tells us that they did not believe the women because their words seemed like nonsense. But then John 20, verse 3 to 8 tells us that Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. They were both running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. And then Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. Now understand, the tomb was more of like a cave in first century Israel that was hollowed out with maybe a stone bed for the body to lie on, and then a stone would be rolled in front of it. It's not like, obviously, tombs as we think of them, graves today. And so Peter saw the strips of cloth, as well as the cloth that had wrapped around Jesus' head. And the cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. And then finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. And the other disciples, it took even more. The scriptures tell us about Jesus appearing in front of them, and they honestly think he's a ghost at first, because I guess what else would you believe if somebody that had died appeared to you out of the blue? And he told them, not only touch me, like prove that I am real, but look at the wounds in my hands and my feet. And then he he does what any good religious or Christian person would do. He says, let me eat. And so he actually eats with his disciples. There's a reason that Christians eat all the time. Major things in Jesus' life revolve around food too. And when they see this, when they see Jesus and they encounter him, scriptures say that Jesus opened their mind and suddenly everything made sense. You see, this was not a surprise, or it shouldn't have been if you had been paying attention. If they had really been thinking and hearing and receiving, Jesus had said multiple times that he would die and then raise again on the third day, over and over and over. And then suddenly what had been foggy was now clear. And they started to put it all together, that this was not a dream and this was not a hallucination, but Jesus was alive. And the events that had taken place that Friday before, Jesus' betrayal and torture and execution, that until this point had been treated as a tragedy, as a grave injustice, and that had been treated as though it's the end of the story, suddenly, ultimately changed, and it became a story of triumph. Jesus snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. And that's the story that we say today. It wasn't over. It may have seemed like the end, because death usually is. They say it's not over till it's over, but even here, it proves that sometimes, even when it's over, there's more to come. Death was no longer it. Death wasn't the end, because Jesus is alive. And it's why we celebrate. It's why Christians have these symbols like the cross that used to be a symbol of hopelessness and death that we now celebrate. And we want to see these. Not because we glory in violence, but because the God that loves us sacrificed himself for us. And then he rose again, proving that he was who he said he was. Proving that all of the things that he declared, all of the things that he said would happen, happened. And so now the cross is no longer a symbol of defeat. Because the cross without the resurrection is incomplete. The cross without the resurrection has no way of declaring what it has done. You see, we teach in the church that the cross did something for us. Jesus defeated evil forces that put a ransom on our lives with the cross. He paid a debt that was our sin incurred on the cross. He bought our freedom on the cross. What Jesus did on the cross was victory. But without the resurrection, we'd never know it. Without Jesus rising again, we would never know the good news. And if good news exists in a vacuum without people to hear it, how good is that news? The victory that was brought by the resurrection changes everything. The cross with the resurrection is triumph. It's a declaration that everything had changed, that everything was new. And it said to those who followed him, that it was not only good news because it's something that happened, but that it was something that changed them too. It's something that not only changes Jesus' story, but it changed their story too. In fact, there's a story that is in the New Testament, in the book of Ephesians, that is written by a guy named Paul. And Paul writes to a church in a place called Ephesus, which is in Greece, and he tells them of the difference that it makes, the difference the resurrection makes. And the core principle that he says, and if you get nothing else out of this, it's that the resurrection of Jesus promises that my life can be resurrected too. Jesus' own resurrection promises my resurrection. And so this guy named Paul, he's told his story before. He actually was born with the name Saul. And Saul was a deeply religious person that when he heard of these people talking about this Jesus who was resurrected from the dead, was so angry that they claimed that this man named Jesus who was executed, he was so angry that they claimed him as God that he orchestrated other religious people to persecute, torture, destroy the lives of, and ultimately even kill those who followed what was called at this time, that followed the way. And Paul, this guy, Saul, was full of hatred and anger. He talks about his anger burning against those who put their faith in Jesus. But it wasn't until he had a miraculous encounter with Jesus while on a mission to a city called Damascus, a city that still exists today in Syria, that changed everything in his life. He encountered Jesus and he adopted a new name, a new identity, and he dedicated his life to proclaiming the good news that Jesus was alive. And that Jesus was alive caused everything to change for him. And so in his letter to this church in Ephesus, in Ephesians chapter 2, it's going to be on the screen for you if you don't have your Bible, he tells them, he says, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient." And then he throws himself in. He says, "All of us lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath." The life that his readers lived were not unlike his own, and their lives are not that unlike ours. On Friday night, if you weren't able to be with us, we took some time to wrestle with the things that hold us back from a relationship with God. Some of these things were sins, mistakes. Some of it is guilt and shame and regret, things that sometimes form our own identity, things that allow us to be held back from God, some things that we even feel like we're shackled to or hold us in chains. Many of us struggle with the choices that we made. You know, we struggle because we live in a world where our actions have consequences, and many of us feel helpless to overcome the choices, the consequences that our choices have brought us. And you could be here, and maybe what you're struggling with today is the consequences of the choices that you're making, and maybe your life now is defined by those consequences. Maybe you're here and you're struggling with addiction. It could be to something like nicotine. It could be to prescription or non-prescription drugs. It could be to any number of chemicals or things that you put in your body. Or it could be a psychological addiction. You know, sometimes that is in some ways harder because it's less of a tactile thing. You can't reach out and grab the thing that you're addicted to. There's no a patch for an addiction to pornography. There's no diet to go on to cure you of anger. But maybe the struggle that you have is not addiction related. Maybe you've just struggled to be the kind of person you know you should be. Maybe you're struggling because you knew the kind of parent you wanted to be, but you didn't live up to the expectations that you place on yourself. And you look in the mirror and think, "Man, I'm a lousy dad," or "Man, I'm a lousy mom." Maybe for you, it's a lifestyle of choices that you never meant to happen, but now it runs your life. Maybe struggling because your drive to success has allowed you to achieve that success, but it's come at a cost and your family life is in tattered, even though you have succeeded in every other way that you can define. Maybe your greed and your desire for more stuff has caused you to cross the line, and instead of making an honest wage, you've stolen, you've cut corners. Maybe you've fudged a little on your taxes, and those little things start to add up, and maybe you haven't been caught, but maybe the back of your mind, it just eats and eats and eats at you. In your mind, you might look at yourself, and you just can't really stand to look at the person in their eye and look right back at them. In your mind, you're nothing but a wretch. You're sinful. Perhaps you say you're stupid. You and your guilt have become your identity. And you're nothing but despicable, wicked, vile, pitiful, and contemptible. Happy Easter, everybody. But you know, in one of the translations that I read, Paul, the language that that translation used, it actually struck me because he refers to walking dead, which means something different to us now because there's a show about that. But you know, there's something to that comparison. The people that walk around and they're surviving, but they're not living. They're walking around and they have perhaps from afar the appearance of life, but when you get up close, there's nothing. I'm not talking about the dummies of the world. I'm talking about like the people devoid of any joy or hope or life. And they wake up and they're miserable and they go through their day longing for the time that they can go to sleep, and it starts all over again. Now, it's something that I've been there, and maybe you're there now. And you know, it's at those low points, it's at our point of greatest struggle that Jesus lowers himself to meet us. You see, the problem with so much of religion is that we try to pump ourselves up to meet God's standard, but what God does is God lowers himself to us to meet us where we are. And for a lot of us, when we look in the mirror and we see the person staring back at us and we fight against that person, sometimes what we need to do is instead of hating us, we need to see that we're missing something. Because until you see yourself as a sinner, you won't see the need for a Savior. And Paul says, whether we realize it or not, we all at one point have been dead, spiritually dead, or maybe even emotionally dead, or maybe in dead relationships. And maybe you're there today. Maybe you know the pain of feeling nothing and feeling numb and feeling like there's got to be something more to life than this. To you, I tell you, Jesus brings a new story. And it's in your darkest place that Jesus shines the brightest. Because in Paul's letter, he doesn't stop there. He declares where they used to be, where these people used to be, and left to their own devices, that's where they would be still. But there's a very significant piece of wording that says, but God. You know what they say about the word but, right? No, I'm not going to give you a chance to reply. B-U-T. The but says that nothing before the but matters. Oftentimes, where I see that is, I can come and give Kevin all kinds of great, I'm sorry, you're sitting in front, you're fair game. I can give him all kinds of compliments and say, you are an amazing person, you've got a great mind, and you like hockey, but you're an idiot for cheering for the wrong hockey team. What do you think he's going to remember from that conversation? The only thing that matters from that is the but and everything after. And in this story, that Paul is weaving, the saying, is true. He spends a fair amount of time reminding his listeners and his readers of where they used to be and how forlorn they were and hopeless they were. He called them dead in their sins. But God. And maybe for you, you need to experience a but God moment. Maybe today will be that day. Maybe you're searching and confused, but God will show you the way through Christ. Maybe you're hurting and empty, but God will fill that void with his Spirit. Maybe you're addicted and in bondage, but God will free you from his truth. You were but God. And hear what the rest of that sentence that Paul says. But God, who is so rich in mercy, and he loved us so much, that even though we were dead because of our sins, he gave us life when he raised Christ from the dead. Because of God's great, insurmountable, incomparable love for you, he wants to give you a new life. He wants to rewrite your story. In fact, there's another passage in Romans chapter 8 that says, the Spirit of God, the power that raised Jesus from the dead, lives in you. And just as God raised Christ from the dead, he will give you life in your mortal bodies. By the same Spirit living in you. Did you hear that? The same Spirit, the same power that raised Christ from the dead is living in you, is available to you, and it can change everything. Because of what God did for us through his death and through his resurrection, our lives can be forever changed. Paul reminds us in Ephesians 2, 8, and 9, God saved you by his grace when you believed. And you can't take credit for it's a gift from God. Salvation is not a reward for the good things that we have done, so none of us can boast about it. It's when we are at our worst that God meets us there. And so you don't need to worry about the things that have come before. You were but God by grace. And we see this play out time and time again. A few weeks ago, we talked about a woman that was caught in adultery, and according to the common thought process of the day, she was guilty and deserved to die. But God showed grace and said, no, you are forgiven. Last week, we talked about a man crucified next to Jesus who, from all accounts, was guilty of everything that he was accused of and was dying a just, according to them, a just death. He was guilty, but God, by grace, said, you are forgiven, and today you will be with me in paradise. And Jordan, an angry teenager who destroyed property and cursed the name of his mother and hated anyone who he encountered, he was messed up, and some might say he is still a little bit. He was on a bad trajectory. He was full of hate. But God, by grace, transformed my heart and rewrote my story. Maybe you're here and your mistakes or your choices define your life. Maybe you've hurt somebody that you care deeply about and it haunts you. Maybe you haven't been the kind of spouse or significant other or brother or sister or friend that you know that you should be. Maybe when you look in the mirror, all you see is your past. Maybe you do anything to change the things that you have done. Maybe you lay in bed at night and you hate yourself. And you wish to yourself, I hope I don't wake up. Friends, Jesus died so that you could be forgiven. Jesus died so that your life no longer has to be defined by your mistakes anymore. The eternal consequences for your mistakes, for your actions, for your crimes are no longer held against you. And Jesus' resurrection tells you that you no longer have to be in bondage to those things anymore. That you can have a new life that looks different, and that you can have victory because of what Jesus did. Jesus rose so that you could rise. Jesus' resurrection means that you can have a resurrection of your own. Your story isn't over. It's only beginning. The same power that raised Jesus from the tomb is in you. The tomb is empty. Jesus is alive, and he wants to give you a new life too. So this morning, I'm going to ask the worship team to come back up. We're going to close with a song of victory, a song that we introduced on Friday, actually. So for some of you, it'll be brand new. But it's a story of declaring victory from defeat. It's a story that says that a cross meant to kill is my victory, because it's no longer a tragedy. This is no longer a story of a man who died, but it's a story of a man who died so that I could live. And this morning, my hope for you is that the victory that Jesus won through his death and resurrection will be your victory too. So I'm going to ask if you would stand with us. We are going to celebrate. This is an anthem song that we as a people can celebrate, because you were, but God, by grace, changed your story. And maybe even right now, he's rewriting the narrative of your life. And if you embrace that story, everything can be different for you too.